Have you noticed that today old music doesn't die? It doesn't even fade away. Instead, it lives on forever as an MP3 file or a box set or a tribute album. And our guest this hour says our addiction to the past in tributes, reruns, mashups, and revivals is starving the present. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be keeping you company today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Simon Reynolds. He's the author of the book Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. And we welcome your calls this hour. Do you think pop culture is addicted to its own increasingly recent past? And why? Are we witnessing the suffocation of artistic originality? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org or follow along on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Simon Reynolds, it's good to have you with us today.
Good morning.
Well, you're a longtime music critic, so if anybody's got their finger on what's happening in pop culture now, it's probably someone like you. And the thing is, you're getting more and more concerned that we've kind of lost our sense of what now means in terms of art and culture, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you almost have to do a memory exercise to remember what things used to be like. You know, when I was growing up, the past was just not as available. You know, you couldn't just, you know, the internet didn't really exist except for a few academics, I think. I'm talking about the late 70s, early 80s, when I was a teenager and a student. And, you know, if you wanted to find about the past, you had to go and buy records or borrow them from the public library. Now you can just go on YouTube and virtually, not only is there like every possible clip from the past, from TV performances and concerts, from every, you know, practically all of pop history, but people have turned YouTube into a kind of audio library. You know, there's just a lot of people just put the music up there with a still image. So, you know, someone growing up with music now can access everything, you know, really. There's hardly anything that isn't available either as a, you know, a shared file on the internet or as a clip on YouTube, as a sort of sound library thing, as I just mentioned, on YouTube. I mean, so it's so instantly accessible that I think a lot of new bands are kind of almost overwhelmed by the abundance and wealth of the past and find it hard to sort of synthesize all those influences into a kind of original musical voice.
Haven't we always been in love with the past, you know, in one form or another? I guess that's why the word nostalgia is one that everybody knows. What makes now different?
I think it's partly to do with you're quite right. I mean, obviously, human societies and civilizations have tended to look to the past, often a distant past, which they kind of romanticize or sort of see as greater and grander than the present. It's a common human syndrome to think that in the past there was a better society that had equilibrium and just kings ruling there. The happy subjects, and to feel that the present has fallen in some way, or is more chaotic, or just somehow lesser than this golden age. That's quite a common syndrome. And then on the individual level, you know, people are nostalgic and they tend to romanticize their childhoods and see them as more idyllic and simpler and than the present. But I think what's different, specifically with pop culture, in the last 10 years, is just the sheer abundance of it and the availability of it, largely to do with digital culture, to do with the internet, with iPods, with all these amazing technologies for storing and sharing and accessing past culture. And then specifically with, you know, pop music and rock music, there's a lot of past now. It's been around for 50 or almost 60 years. And so there's so much stuff to draw on. There's so many, you know, there are people who can just spend their whole time just obsessing about the minutiae of particular decades or, you know, particular scenes and movements from the past. So you see, you know, rockabillies, there are kids who just live as if they're in the 1950s. You see people obsessed with not just the 60s, but different parts of the 60s. You know, there's people who are obsessed with the early 60s of garage punk and the Birds. There's people who have long hair and obsessed with, you know, the later 60s, and they, you know, a band like Fleet Foxes, their whole thing is based around the Crosby, Stills and Nash records they found in their parents' collection. they even have the beards to go with it. You know, they have this sort of late, you know, that period in the late 60s when all the rock stars suddenly grew beards, you know, because they wanted to seem all grown up and mature. So I think that it's a combination of just pop's been around a long time, and we have this technology to access instantly.
As long as you brought up the Fleet Foxes, and you said they're a callback to an earlier era, let's take a listen to them.
You're ever welcome with me anytime you like. Let's drive to the countryside, leave behind some green-eyed lookalike. So no one gets worried, no.
A clip from the song Blue Ridge Mountains by the Fleet Foxes. And, you know, you listen to a track like that, it sounds pretty lovely. So what's wrong with going back and kind of redoing what's been done before when it sounds so good?
I do actually kind of like the Fleet Foxes, but it is such a sort of simulacrum of, you know, that particular track you picked. I couldn't have picked a more Crosby, Stills and Nash sound-alike track. And the fact that they have the look as well, and the fact that, you know, in the interviews they talk very openly that the inspiration comes from the records they found in their parents' record collection. You know, Crosby, Stills and Nash, the band, Joni Mitchell, Fairport Convention. I suppose it's true that they are talented and they've come up with good stuff in that old mode, but I guess from my point of view, I've always thought that pop music and rock music were always moving forward, always evolving, always going somewhere different. And for me, I'm always looking for the surprise. I'm looking for a kind of blissful feeling of disorientation, you know. And it's particularly ironic when people do, you know, hark back to the 60s, because the 60s is when that was such a dominant idea. Everything was about the new, you know, the breaking with tradition, and you know, people were, like the Beatles and Hendrix were like, you know, exploring the potential of the studio, effects on the guitars, you know, creating these groundbreaking, forward-looking records. So to hark back to them, to that era, is kind of going against the spirit of that era in some way. So I guess that's, for me, I'm just surprised in the year 2011 that, you know, such a popular group is so based on an old style of music. It just seems, I'd expected things to be a bit more futuristic and weird by the time we got to the 21st century.
Well, you know, one of the theories about making art and making music is that if you're an apprentice artist, what you do is you set out to completely learn the rules of what came before you can break the rules. Is that part of what we're seeing, or are people just not interested in breaking the rules anymore?
Well, that's a good point. It's true that most artists, when they start out, do have an imitative phase. I mean, I think when the Beatles started out, they were very much, you know, wanting to sound like Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and people like that. Same with the Rolling Stones. They were obsessed with and modeled themselves on blues people, electric blues people, Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf, and a bit of, there was some Chuck Berry in there, and a lot of their early records had lots of cover versions on. But, you know, to me, the mark of a great artist is starting with something, but, you know, it's a launch pad or a diving board for you to go into new territory. That metaphor got a bit mixed. you know what I mean? It's like,
right.
You have an influence, but it's a starting point, you know. With really, really creative musicians today, having all this history is great because, you know, you have 50, 60 years of starting points, of launch pads, you know. But I think a lot of groups tend to just stick with the copying phase, the imitative phase. I mean, you know, the Fleet Foxes are not a tribute band. They're not playing Crosby, Stills and Nash material. What's slightly eerie is that they're writing new songs that are totally in another person's style. And I think that's just a bit, it's not as exciting as someone who comes up with something really original and different. But it is the idea that artists express themselves uniquely is a fairly recent notion. It's a sort of modern era notion, and in fact, in the Middle Ages in the West and in a lot of Asian cultures and other cultures, the idea of being original doesn't exist. You know, people just do the traditional songs, and the art is much more about craftsmanship. It's about mastering how things are done, the right way to do things. You don't make them quirky or individual. That's actually, it is a sort of modern Western notion, the idea that artists should always be doing something different.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you write about is that, you know, if you look at some of the most creatively fertile times in recent pop music, you know, the 60s, the 70s, a lot of what made that music, that art so alive, is that it was tied to these enormous sweeping social movements. You know, is that part of the problem now, that we just don't have a social movement that everyone agrees on to get behind, so that it's not really feeding any kind of artistic process?
I think you're right that there was a kind of connection to history, in the sense of, you know, what was happening socially, politically, if, you know, turbulence and events that was feeding into the music. I think of music during the 60s or during punk rock, certainly the golden age of hip-hop as well. There's a kind of sense that the music is about something, or it's connected to something beyond music, and that is feeding and driving it. But I think with music generally, but particularly with rock music, there's a point at which that sort of connection to history, to the social, to all these energies seem to sort of weaken, and you start to get a lot of music that was kind of about other music. You know, it was sort of meta music in a sense. And a lot of music that's inspired only by love of earlier music. And some of it's, really lovely. You know, Fleet Foxes' records are fun to listen to. Very pretty, and there are some people I think who do that who are kind of geniuses. There's this guy Ariel Pink, who's based in Los Angeles and has made some remarkable records that are, you know, very much inspired by sort of memories of the golden age of 70s radio rock, the early days of MTV and sort of new wave music, and it's very informed by the past, but there's something sort of magic to it. But I think there are limits to it, and I think there's a definite sense in which music has become disconnected from broader social currents. Doesn't seem to be expressing them anyway in the way that it used to.
Why do you think that is?
There's a combination of factors that perhaps there's a feeling that, you know, there used to be an idea that a song could change the world. You know, that would have been an operative notion for someone like John Lennon. You know, just you say that what he thought was the truth, and people will hear those words, and they'll be changed, and then it'll be a snowball of change. And, you know, he stuck with that idea all through his solo career. But I suppose people have lost faith with that, and the power of a song to sort of change people or motivate them. There's also a sense that, you know, again, it's this thing of the build-up of history as it gathers behind rock. Encourages more and more people to sort of make music where the primary emotion in it is sort of love of other music, you know. So it's kind of homage, it's kind of invoking these sort of golden ages of music.
Well, one of the things you talk about on your blog is you recently watched the Music Video Awards. And I guess that was a pretty much, as you saw it, a smorgasbord of retromania. Everything there, not everything, but a lot of it was just a rehash of what you'd seen before. Can you take us through some of it?
Yeah, I would. You know, I was watching it, and I got very excited because I was like, wow, this is like a, it's almost like they've done it on purpose just to help me, promote my book. So many things that had a retro element. I mean, some of it was just the artists, like, for instance, I was very sort of pleased when Adele had the biggest record of the year, because it was such a useful thing to talk about when people ask me about my book, because, you know, she is, it's a good example of non-innovative music. You know, Adele's Rolling in the Deep is very much a 45-year-old style of music. It could have come out in the mid-60s, and that song. And, you know, her biggest influence is Etta James, who was, you know, most successful during the early 60s. And, you know, it's rhythm and blues. There's barely any indication that it was made in 2011. And that's the biggest record in the country. So when she performed her other song, I think it's Something About You, everything about it, she was singing with just the piano. I think she had an old-fashioned microphone. She was wearing a kind of vintage dress. She was doing these hand gestures, you know, sort of hand hovering over her heart. It was just very kind of like a time warp, I thought. It was very strange. Then you had things like Chris Brown's 90s tribute, which was this, I don't know whose idea it was or what it was meant to signify, but he was doing this weird dancing. Then they cut from, you know, a robot voice went 1991, and then they had a sort of very bad version of Smells Like Teen Spirit. They cut to 1993, and it was a very bad version of, what was it? It was something, I think, oh yeah, it was Protect Your Neck, which is like the first single by the Wu-Tang Clan. So, you know, early to mid-90s hip-hop. And then a voice said, the robot voice said, the present, the future, and Chris Brown played his latest single, which to me just sounds like sort of 90s techno music, techno pop, very mainstream sort of house music from the early 90s. Didn't seem like the present or the future.
Definitely not the future then. Was it in the 90s? I mean, the funny thing is, isn't it too soon to be getting nostalgic for the 90s? I mean, they don't seem that long ago or that different.
Well, I think that's interesting that it doesn't seem that long ago. I think there's something about the fact that it still feels quite recent, you know, is indicative of the way our sense of pop time has changed. It doesn't feel like a long time ago, but I guess to people who are 17 or 18, 19, you know, perhaps they associate hearing that kind of stuff on the radio was when they were toddlers or something. I think that my math is right. They might not have been born, actually. But, you know, it has that kind of... Perhaps it has a house, you know, perhaps the era when a lot of young people had long hair and wore flannel and those kind of heavy sounds on the radio, perhaps that has a kind of nostalgic thing. Or maybe it's just fascinating, you know. It was an interesting... You know, obviously, I think part of it was that it was exciting... But, you know, a lot of things happened in the 90s, but a lot of people, when you say the 90s, will think of grunge. And that was an exciting period in the sense that the radio suddenly changed. You know, it went from hair metal bands to a different sound, and MTV suddenly was full of these, you know, grungy, rather gloomy groups. It was one of those exciting moments when there's an all change in music, and the bands were angry and frustrated, and the lyrics were a bit kind of realer and grittier than the hair metal bands like Bon Jovi and Warrant that had, you know, Poison that had been
well, if we can take it a little broader, I mean, what you're describing here isn't limited to the world of music. I know that's your specialty, but you can see the same thing happening in, you know, film or TV.
Yes, I think, you know, the book's about Retromania as a syndrome effect, you know, a sort of paradigm across pop culture, and particular areas even more affected than others. Music, I think, is one of the most strongly affected. Fashion has been like this for a long while. It's been a kind of recycling thing of old ideas. I spoke to a fashion professor, Valerie Steele, and she told me that the people in the fashion world started reviving the 80s almost as soon as the 80s was over. Like there were like three different periods when people were returning to 80s ideas during the 90s, and then in the actual last decade, 80s revivals went crazy in fashion and music, all kinds of things. You get it also in the design world. A lot of designers and graphic designers, interior designers are into mid-century modern furniture, into period look kind of fonts and typography. And then in the movie world, you know, I think it's slightly less endemic, but you do have a very big phenomenon of remakes and sequels. And the remakes, I would say, on the whole, are a lot less aesthetically successful than a band like the Fleet Foxes who do a good job of this old style. I mean, there are hardly any. Can you think of any good remakes of movies?
There's been comic book adaptations. I think Thor was pretty good, but then you look, there was a whole bunch of movies made about old 80s TV shows, at least.
Yeah.
Well, there's the A-Team, I know, for one, and those don't seem to be as successful.
I think commercially they're successful. I think that's why people do them, but I think, nearly always, particularly comedies seem to be really a really bad idea when there's an iconic comedy like Arthur or the Pink Panther,
right,
or
Inspector, right,
Clouseau, and you get really talented comic actors trying to recreate what was already an absolutely, iconic performance, Inspector Clouseau or Dudley Moore as Arthur. These people define the character. To get a current actor to replay, I don't know why the studios don't just re-release the original great movies, but
right,
that seems to be something. There's some kind of financial logic, I think, behind that. I don't know. It's not quite the same phenomenon as retro in rock, where there's a sort of longing to go back in time, I think, or a fascination for the past. I think a lot in movie remakes, it's just about money. It's about this thing. They use this term in the business, a pre-sold concept. The idea is that you have people who saw the film the first time around, and then you have other people who've heard of the film but want to see it remade with younger actors and, a glitzier modern look. And you don't get in TV, there isn't really so much of a retro thing, I don't think. Perhaps because there's always been a thing of TV repeats. And, Seinfeld has never been off the air, really, has it, since it first
showed. I don't think it's ever gone away totally. Well, as we talk this hour about Retromania, we're joined by Simon Reynolds, who is a music critic and the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. And we want to know what you think. Do you think pop culture is addicted to its own increasingly recent past? And do you think what we're seeing is going to affect originality? The idea of seeing something new that we've never seen before or heard before. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A mashup of Lady Gaga's song, Born This Way, with Madonna's Express Yourself. I guess showing that Lady Gaga is already nostalgic for the days of good old Madonna tunes. We're talking about the love affair we seem to be having in American culture with all things from the past, and the pretty recent past, too. Our guest is Simon Reynolds. He's a music critic and the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. I'm Veronica Rickert. And Simon, do you want to talk a little bit about Lady Gaga?
Yeah, well, Lady Gaga is a sort of kind of an archetypal, what they call a recombinant star, insofar as, she's pulled all these things from the past. There's a bit of Bowie in there, well, a lot of Bowie, I think, in the sense of the idea of constantly reinventing yourself and changing your persona. There's obviously a lot of Madonna, particularly with Born This Way, which does have this striking resemblance to Express Yourself. There's, in the music, there's a bit of Queen, there's some Elton John, there's she's very much pulling from all these. A lot of it's to do with the tradition of music of glam rock and glitter, really, and sort of shock rock, so I think there's, she's in the lineage of the kind of theatrics that Alice Cooper did, that Marilyn Manson did, this kind of where there's a lot of spectacle, there's a lot of where rock is rock and pop are kind of blending into theatre in a kind of sensationalistic way. I mean, I enjoy her as a phenomenon. I'm not a massive fan of her music, but I think as a cultural phenomenon, she's she's good value. I particularly enjoyed the whole, you know, rumor she started that she was a hermaphrodite. I thought that was an interesting move, because it takes the whole thing, you know, because glam rock was always about gender bending and androgyny, and you know, she took it to the next level. I mean, it's hard to see how you could top some of the things that were done by people like Alice Cooper and Marilyn Manson and Bowie and the rest, but she managed to find a way, a new thing, a new form of gender bending.
Let's go to our phones now. We've got Greg joining us from Madison. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Well, you guys have certainly covered a lot of stuff since I first called in. I was going to take issue with the idea that, which is how you frame the intro to the show, Veronica, that your guest says we need a cultural garbage disposal bin, mm-hmm. because we have too much accumulation of culture. And since I've been listening, I get that your guest really cares about music. And if he really cared, then I think he should do more of an analysis on the music industry like he was doing in the music industry, where recycling stuff makes good business sense, because you have both markets. You have the new kids who've never heard before. You have the older people who want to hear it. And there's a huge filter of people who want to make music, but the music industry narrows that down, and then they just retire artists over and over and over again. Just think of the 80s. You know, Timbuktu, which was a great band that came out of Madison, had one hit. They put out four albums, but we never heard from them again because we were listening to The Flock of Seagulls or Cyndi Lauper. And so we've always had a disposable culture, and I'd like to invite you to consider that the source of our culture is the industry, not the Internet. The Internet is actually counter-cultural, and there's nothing wrong with making everything available on the Internet. That's just that's a good thing.
Okay, interesting take, Greg. What do you think, Simon?
I think there's certainly a case for saying that the record industry does like a high turnover of stars, and there is a sort of inbuilt obsolescence thing built into it. But at the same time, you know, the industry has also been heavily involved in reissues and, you know, certainly in the concert promotions industry, there's an awful lot of promoting of reunited acts, of, you know, this whole phenomenon of the Don't Look Back phenomenon, where bands play their most sort of famous, beloved and iconic record, they play it all the way through. And that was invented by a promoter in Britain, but then copied very widely. And all kinds of people have done it, like Van Morrison, and just about everybody really has, any famous established band, and quite a few cult bands as well, have done this thing of playing their most famous album all the way through, because it's, you know, people love, fans love it, and it's a bit of a money spinner as well. So I think, you know, it's true that the record industry traditionally has been about high turnover and disposability, but there's also the birth of a nostalgia industry as well, and of a recycling the past. You know, so many record labels put out, you know, when the anniversary comes around of a record, as we can see with Nirvana's Nevermind, the industry is very keen to put it out again in a sort of spiffy form, with, you know, the bonus disc, with, you know, alternate versions and demos. And I think with Nevermind, they're putting it out in a 4-CD version, you know, where there's like, you know, they've even got like, not just demos, but they've got like versions of all those songs recorded on a boombox in a rehearsal room. They managed to dig up a tape of that. So the industry does have is also trying to make money out of preserving the past and making it available again.
And what about the Internet being a counterculture influence?
Well, I think I kind of feel that's a bit of a 90s view. I mean, I think, like, you know, the Internet did seem to be like this wild and free zone. And there's a lot of people, you know, doing fun, expressive, minority specialist activities on there. But, you know, it's a fairly colonized terrain. There's a lot of big, big corporations operating on the Internet, and you know, it's not like a total free zone anymore, I don't think. And there's no doubt that there are many great things about having all this sort of old culture easily available. I mean, I could spend hours and hours just, and I do, drifting across YouTube, looking at old TV commercials I can remember from when I was a teenager or a small kid in the 70s. I'm grateful to whoever it was who actually recorded them off their TV in the 70s and then now stuck them up on YouTube. But I think it's a peculiar thing to have so much. It's a disorienting thing to have so much access to the past. Compared with how much you could live, you tended to live in. I can remember when you very much lived in a sort of a cultural present tense. You were like mostly concerned with new stuff that was coming out people were more synchronized, I think, in a way. Like people were all focused on the present much more, whereas now the past offers all these little niches and places people can kind of huddle. So it's harder for people to sort of form consensuses or unite around bands or phenomenon, I think.
Well, thank you for that call. And we go now to Leslie, joining us from Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hello. My comment is that as far as like TV or old commercials and old movies and stuff, that to me, when I see old stuff, doesn't do anything for me because I keep thinking of all the new technology and the new special effects. And I think that genre keeps getting better in a lot of ways. I mean, there's classics that are fun to watch, but you're always thinking, oh man, look at the quality. But music is totally different in my eyes, where the music that I grew up with, that I started listening to when I was 13, let's see, that would have been about 69. We just had the best music ever made. So to me, they could stop making music right now, and I'd be fine. I could listen. I like different kinds of music, and I like new music. But the rock and roll that I grew up with, and that was ingrained in me when I was young, that brings back something that nothing that I would hear now or on out would bring that feeling into my chest. You know, it's just, there's something about music, like Alzheimer's people, whatever they listened to when they were young and informative and all that, impressionable or whatever, it's not stored in their memory, it's stored in their heart.
Yeah, and as Simon was saying, there is something special about that music from the 60s and 70s, and there's a reason that we keep going back to it. What's your take on that, Simon?
Well, I think, obviously, it's a common syndrome that people tend to have the strongest feelings about the music they heard when they were really impressionable, when music was new to them, and you know, it's like your first time you fall in love. You know, you'll never forget what that was like, and so it does tend to be that the music experience you have when you're young become a kind of benchmark or a sort of ideal that kind of lasts your whole life. I tend to agree, though, with the caller that there is a sort of an objective excellence to a lot of the music, a sort of surpassing brilliance and achievement to a lot of the music of the 60s and 70s. Partly it's related to the fact that it was a new area of culture, a new zone, a new music form that was discovering itself, testing itself, pushing forward. You know, the music technology went through very rapid advances during you know, even the career of the Beatles. You know, it went from like very simple recording to 8-track to, you know, they were doing, it allowed them to do all kinds of amazing things in the studio, and also the equipment available to bands in terms of sounds and texturizing the music and effects and what you could do with amplification, all that was being discovered really for the first time. You know, what difference it made to music to play it really, really loud through a big sound system. That was all being invented. So there's a tremendous sense of movement on all fronts. People, rock was developing, it was embracing influences from jazz, from world music, funk and soul were evolving through people like Sly Stone and James Brown. Reggae emerged. You know, it was a tremendous sense of everything happening really in the present tense, influences fertilizing each other and sparks flying from all that. So there's that quality of discovery and going into the unknown kind of is audible still in the music at that time. So when you play an album by The Doors or an album by, you know, an early album by Led Zeppelin or, you know, any number of groups. There's just something about that music that is timeless, but still also has that quality of, you know, an art form that is birthing itself, you know. So that's, I think I agree with the caller there. It's difficult because, you know, young musicians now, there are a lot of talented young musicians, but they do have this enormous legacy to sort of contend with. And I kind of feel for them in a way because I think the birthright of young musicians and young people is to, you should kind of feel like you're living through the best time ever. Like the caller felt when she was young, and when I felt a bit later when I grew up during the sort of new wave post-punk era. But a lot of young bands I noticed seem to have the idea that the best times are in the past, you know, and that's why they, you know, that's why you get bands like Fleet Foxes who sound like the late 60s.
Well, as we go to our break here, let's listen to Creedence Clearwater Revival. This is one from the decades that Leslie was talking about. As we talk this hour about retromania, about our love affair with our own past, you hear it in music, and we've also talked about how you see it in other aspects of culture as well, including fashion and design and film. And we're talking with Simon Reynolds, music critic and author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. And we want to know what you think. Do you agree that pop culture is addicted to its own very recent past? And why do you think we're seeing that? What happens, do you think, to originality and novelty, newness, when we have such a tendency to look backward and to borrow from the past? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Little instrumental there from the New York Dolls on their reunion tour from Chicago in 2006. One of many bands who seems to make a business out of going on reunion tours long after their main heyday has passed. And we're talking this hour about pop culture's addiction to its own past with our guest Simon Reynolds, who is a music critic and author of the book Retromania. And let's head now to our next caller. We've got Stephen with us somewhere on the road. Hi, Stephen.
How you doing? First of all, let me say I'm a 27-year-old, and I love music of the crooner era, you know, Frank Sinatra and Andy Williams. And I think what was so great about that generation of music, and up until the point that MTV came around, is that artists were distinguished by their sound, by having a unique sound. You knew who was singing the song on the radio. But it seems like more in recent times that pop music is more about the image the artist portrays, not necessarily the sound they've created. As long as they're recognizable in media and on television, that sells records now, not so much the sound that they have. And I think MTV kind of brought that about with the music video, with tying music to an image and making music more memorable that way by the image that the artist creates as opposed to the sound that they have. And I think today on the radio, it's so hard to distinguish pop artists between, you know, from one another because they don't have a unique sound. They're more catering to a unique image.
Hmm. All right. Thanks, Stephen. Simon?
Sorry. I was just listening to Frank Sinatra's Songs for Swinging Lovers earlier this week. I grew up on that music. My parents were into it. And, he's a titanic figure and, as amazing a performer as the 20th century produced. So I think it would be cool. It's cool to hear that someone is young but is a fan of that music. Frank Sinatra's greatest records were made when he was about 40, I think. I think he'd been a teeny bopper kind of star, and by the time he was making his classic albums, he'd been singing and learning about phrasing and, you know, the art of singing and putting across personality and almost speaking the songs as well as singing them. You know, he'd been perfecting that for quite a while. I think a lot of pop stars, you know, they start their stars much younger in their careers. They haven't developed that personality and that individual style. And a lot of being a pop star, as the caller rightly points out, a lot of being a pop star now is you don't have to be just a good singer. You have to look good. You have to dance. You have to almost act because, you know, a lot of videos kind of have a, almost a cinematic quality. You know, you have a whole range of, you know, and increasingly stars don't just want to be singers and performers. They want to be have their own clothing lines and all these sort of spin-offs. So it's almost like you're a kind of transmedia operator rather than a singer. Being a singer is just one component of being a star these days, I think, and people are looking to go move into movies as soon as they can. And so I think there's something to be said for the fact that the musical side of modern pop stars has diminished a bit. Another thing, just quickly to say, is that one reason pop music seems more faceless and characterless is the rise of this technology called autotune that is just endemic, where it's a pitch correction technology, which is makes the reason why most pop songs on the radio have this sort of kind of perfect sounding voices that are a bit kind of samey is because they've all been put through your autotune. All the little fluctuations in pitch that are a normal part of singing have been ironed out, and they sort of sound like these sort of slightly robotic, post-human, superhuman kind of voices. And that's, you know, and they've done that even to people who are good singers. Like, you know, Britney Spears has, you know, one of the things she's got going for her is she's got a kind of nice, husky voice, but they've put her through autotune on her recent records. And so she sort of sounds just like everybody else. It's like this sort of identikit kind of omni-pop cyborg kind of voice that everyone has.
You know, I'm surprised people want to hear that in a way, because it seems to me that the era we're in right now is one where people really want authenticity. They want things to be real, and the last thing you want is a cyborg singer.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I think it's actually changed singing styles, because everyone, the sort of tone of people's voices is kind of uniform. A lot of the skill of singing is now about rhythm and syncopation. So someone like Justin Bieber, who's actually technically a really good singer, if you listen to him, a lot of what he's doing that makes it interesting is more rhythmic. It's more like coming almost out of an influence from rap and things like that. But the actual tone of someone's voice, the timbre, is everyone, that's kind of the individuality of that has kind of been ironed out by autotune.
Mm. Well, you could start a new record label, Simon, and have it could be the No Autotune label.
I bet you that's going to be a gimmick, a marketing gimmick in music. No, you know, no autotune used on this record.
Well, it'd be nice to hear what people's voices actually sound like.
I think there are still probably more in indie music, there's people who don't use autotune, but it has, I think in pop music, it's almost like pop music and sort of mainstream rock music, it's just universal to use this device. It's strange.
Well, thank you for that call, and let's move on now. We've got Andrew joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I was just interested to call in. We heard people talking about Fleet Foxes earlier, and touching on their roots from the 60s sound, and talking about this lack of branching out from, you know, our recent history, and, you know, just kind of thinking about how people do what's natural to them, and they grow up listening to these kind of records like Neil Young and other folk artists, and it just comes out in how they play their music, and it, you know, it's a natural progression of things.
It's to sort of build on what you hear growing up. If you're an artist, maybe that's natural.
I think, you know, there's an element where that goes on. I suppose what's interesting to me is that the generation gap thing that used to be such a important part of how music changed. You know, the whole idea that, you know, you kids embrace a sound that almost deliberately that their parents don't think is music, proper music, you know. That seems to have collapsed, and it's a really common phenomenon. I think it's a problem of young people. What do you do if your parents are cool? How can you rebel against them? I come across, I interview young musicians all the time, and I hang out with young music critic bloggers, and it's amazing how often it's the parents who played in the Velvet Underground, or the parents who, you know, were playing the Sex Pistols when these kids were growing up. So how can you rebel against that? Perhaps you don't want to rebel against that. Perhaps if your parents are cool, you want to be like them, you know. And there's a big phenomenon now. It's particularly big in Britain, but I think it's going on in the States too, where whole families go to rock festivals, you know. The parents who are middle-aged go, but the teenagers or student-age kids come with their parents, and they all camp in a caravan or in a tent, and they go and see the same bands together, which is such an interesting thing. When I grew up, I love my parents' Sinatra records, but rock music was my thing. You know, they weren't into rock, and it was a way of, identity formation was a big part of being into music. You know, you defined yourself through your music choices, and part of that defining yourself was being different from your parents. And that doesn't seem to operate anymore. So I thought it was very indicative that the Fleet Foxes, you know, based their sound on the stuff they found in their parents' record collections. It seemed like to speak to this change.
Well, I think there's some research on the different generations, you know, in terms of millennials and Generation X and how they relate to their parents. And I think, I could have this wrong, but I thought that millennials were actually supposed to be pretty close with their parents. So, you know, if they're close with their parents, they're not going to rebel against their music, most likely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably there's been changes in parenting approaches, less disciplinary and more like, you know, being friends with your kids. And also there's the phenomenon of a lot of young people still live at home much longer than they used to, I think, you know, partly for economic reasons. So, but yeah, it's an interesting change in what, you know, the whole idea of youth culture itself has kind of faded a bit. It's you know, you have bands where the spread of people at the audience is really, really wide, you know, people in their late 50s down to teenagers. So this, you know, and certainly I think with artists that I view as kind of retro-y, often they're drawn to old styles just because that's the nature of their voice or their talent, you know, like Adele sings the music she does because she happens to have a voice that lends itself to that, you know. So there's definitely, you know, defenses you can make for people doing these very traditional styles. I just find that the accumulation of all of them, so many bands doing quite old, established styles of music, like, you know, Mumford & Sons doing bluegrass, it's. I find it a bit non-futuristic. It's a bit not what I expected in the year 2011.
Well, where do you see this going? Do you see this as kind of a trend that's playing out? I mean, maybe that is the hallmark of our time, that we are looking back. Do you see us breaking out of it and getting out of the thrall of all the old stuff that's lurking around on the internet? Or is it just going to continue like this? Are we kind of at the end of music history?
I don't think we're at the end of music history. I think human beings are, you know, immensely ingenious and creative, and there's always going to be new things that they come up with. It does seem to be a particular moment where a bunch of things have converged. The sort of the age of rock and pop is as a sort of something that's in its 50s. And has a big past behind it, the digital technology and file sharing and the sort of abundance of all these influences from the past. And also it's a time when things are actually, you know, it's quite hard to think about the future. Because things are pretty bleak in terms of the economy and lots of other areas, the environment and everything. So there is a sort of tendency to look back just because it's hard to make a positive picture of the future right now. So I think all these things have converged. I'm fairly confident that this pattern is going to break. People are talking about a 90s revival now a lot. I can't imagine there's going to be talk of a noughties revival, about whatever we're calling the aughts or the 2000s or whatever the name is.
Run out of material at a certain point, I guess.
Yeah, well, because such a big thing in that last decade that we lived through was the 80s revival. How can you have a revival of 80s stuff, you know? It's like, so I'm hoping the pattern is going to break, and it could happen through some new technology that transforms music. It could happen through influences from the rest of the world influencing Western music, you know. There's a lot of scenarios.
Well, we'll have to watch it and see what happens. We'll be listening. Simon Reynolds, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Veronica.
Simon Reynolds, music critic and the author of the book Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. Thank you to Chrissy Pease for answering your phone calls and producing this hour. And thank you to Rhonda Fanning for her technical direction as well. And thanks to you for listening and for calling in. And don't forget, you can follow along on our Facebook page. It's the Veronica Rickard Show. And you'll find a link at WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.